This message is from the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.
We began the biography of Abraham, the first pioneer, and discovered in him a man who was willing to leave it all behind, everything that represented security and stability. He left his society, he left his family. He was instructed by God to leave everything that had been his for so many years, to walk away and go to an unknown land that God had promised to give him. I wonder if we would have obeyed. But Abraham did. In fact, you'll discover in Genesis chapter 12 with me, as we review the promise, that Abraham, in fact, did obey. Verse 1, "Now the Lord said to Abram, Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abraham went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him." That was a mistake, as we'll discover later. "Now Abraham was 75 years old when he departed for Haran. And Abram took Sarai his wife and Lot his nephew and all their possessions which they had accumulated." Perhaps you know what it's like to move everything you've accumulated. Wonder how in the world you held all that stuff in the attic. Well, he cleaned it out and he took it with him and all the persons which they had acquired in Haran, that is the servants, and they set out for the land of Canaan. What an adventure. Thus they came to the land of Canaan. He will now build two different altars, highly significant. And let me tell you where he builds them. The first is at the Oak of Moreh. Let's read on in verse 6. "And Abram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem, to the Oak of Moreh," or the tree of Moreh. Now the Canaanite was then in the land. You need to understand that this is a literal tree. This is a location. Moreh means teacher. And in old times, during the days of Abraham, there would be the guru, the teacher, who sat at a tree. And this was the tree of Moreh. This was the oak of the teacher. And this idolatrous guru was supposed to be able to hear the voices of the gods as they rustled through the trees, or the leaves of the tree. And at this very spot, this idolatrous location, Abraham sets up an altar. And what a man of courage. It's as if he says, "I know that you have your idolatrous practice, but God has promised me the land. And so right here under the leaves of this oak tree, I build an altar to my God." The second place he builds an altar is between Bethel and Ai. Look at verse 7. "Now the Lord appeared to Abram and said to your descendants, I will give this land." By the way, this is the first time Abram now understands that it's Canaan. He builds an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. "Then he proceeded from there to the mountain on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent, Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord." Now here again, these places are highly symbolic or significant. Ai literally means pile of rubbish. It was symbolic of the temporal world. In fact, it would be a terrible place for the Israelites in their history as it would develop, you'll discover as we go through the Old Testament. Bethel literally means the house of God. And this was symbolic of everything that represented the presence, the fellowship of God, including heaven or the kingdom. And right in the middle, right between the pile of rubbish representing the world and the coming kingdom or the place of God, Abram builds an altar. Now I want you to understand first, before we go any further, the importance of the altar. Number one, it represents a place of worship. You note here in verse 7 that a theophany has occurred. A theophany is the appearance of the form of God. No man has ever seen God and lived. So this is what we consider theologically a theophany. That is, the visible glory of God came to Abraham as if he gave him an outline of his figure, but he never saw his face. This represented then the place where Abram would worship God. It also represented a place of fellowship. This is a wonderful day. Abraham has made it through the desert. He's arrived in the land. God says, "This is the land that I'm going to give you." He builds an altar and has fantastic, wonderful fellowship with the glory of God. He is excited. He's thrilled. Everything is wonderful. And then, bang, next verse. He lives happily ever after. No. Verse 10, Then there was a famine in the land. Right in the middle of the third verse, God interrupts his rejoicing with a famine. I wonder how we respond when God interrupts our rejoicing with a period of famine. What do you do? How do you respond when a trial or a test knocks on your door? Especially when it comes on the heels of close communion and fellowship. It leaves us scratching our heads. We can't figure it out. I thought, Lord, I've arrived. I'm in Canaan. Here's the altar. Great fellowship. Bang. A trial. This is the time when you think it's not worth it. After all the acts of faithfulness, guess what God does? I think of Jesus Christ himself in Luke chapter 3, who went under the waters of baptism, and when he came back out, his Father's voice was heard from heaven saying, "Look, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." Luke chapter 3. Luke chapter 4, he's led by the Spirit in the wilderness to be tested by Satan. I want to give you something to jot down, and I want you to remember it. This is something that most Christians never grab onto, and as a result, check out when famine comes into their lives. It is this: initial obedience is the starting point on the road to spiritual maturity. It's the starting point. We have the idea that it's the final destination. Lord, I surrender to you. I want to be like Christ. Well, great. Takes care of my sanctification. I'm here. I've arrived. And all of a sudden, God brings a trial into your life, and you say, "Hey, wait a second, Lord. What are you doing?" And God says, "I'm answering your prayer. I'm going to make you like Christ." But wait a second. I said I wanted to be like Christ. I said I want to surrender. God, in effect, responds, "I don't necessarily care that you say that. I want you to experience it. I want it to be a reality in your life." And so testing comes to do just that. What lay ahead for Abraham in terms of spiritual growth? Well, in the next 10 verses, we'll find out. But before we get into that, and before we're too hard on Abraham for checking out and heading for Egypt, I want you to notice the question that he is probably asking. It is this. You and I have asked the same thing. God, where are your promises? Where are they? Abraham had three. God said, "I will give you the land." Abraham gets there and he looks around and he sees the Canaanites with their chariots of iron, with their armies led by bloodthirsty pagans. "This is wonderful, Lord. The promise of the seed, you will have a myriad of descendants." He still is without child. "The promise of blessing, I will bless you." Here comes a famine. So Abraham asks the question, "Where are the promises?" He probably scratches his head and he says, "Well, isn't there a verse in the Bible now that says God helps them that helps themselves?" And so he heads for Egypt. He retreats in cowardly fear. Read verses 10 and 11 with me. "Now there was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. And it came about that when he came near to Egypt that he said to Sarah his wife," and we'll get into those words in just a moment, but I want you to understand that Abraham is heading for the place that throughout the Old Testament represents rebellion to God and bondage to the world. You see, help was not in Egypt. Help was at the altar. He just built it. I think that the angels in heaven were probably saying, "Abram, stay there. We've got a recipe for manna. We'd like to use it." They probably say, "Shucks, now we got to wait till Moses comes along." They know that there are rocks there that are ready for gushing if he will only go to God. But he cannot see the promises, and so he begins leaning on his own understanding, his own reason, and he heads for Egypt. Ladies and gentlemen, if you had walked up to Abraham right in between these two verses and you said, "Listen, Abraham, I want you to understand that in about 3 months, you're going to be alone in Egypt, sitting in a tent, your wife has just been added to the harem of the Pharaoh, and you are increasing in herds," he would have said, "You're reading the wrong tea leaves or something." "Not me!" Ah, but we'll discover that's exactly what happened. One verse before we go further. The prophet Isaiah writes these words. Do you see yourself in these words? Note very carefully. "Woe to the rebellious children, says the Lord, who take counsel, but not from me, who devise plans, but not of my spirit, that they may add sin upon sin, who walk to go down to Egypt and have not asked my advice, to strengthen themselves in the strength of Pharaoh." and to trust in the shadow of Egypt. Therefore the strength of Pharaoh shall be your shame, and trust in the shadow of Egypt shall be your humiliation. And I think we could add a postscript to these words. And when you go down to Egypt, when you trust in the world system, when you do not ask my counsel nor my advice, don't blame me when you get in a mess. See, the last thing Abram could say when he got down to Egypt and all of this stuff started to happen that we're going to look at, he can't look up and say, Lord, why in the world did you do this to me? It's a result of his rebellion. And many times we rebel against God, we get away from God, we don't ask advice or counsel, and we get boxed into a corner, and guess who we give the credit to? God. I want you to notice what happens in verse 11. He comes to Egypt, and he said to Sarah, his wife, see now, I know that you are a beautiful woman, and it will come about when the Egyptians see you that they will say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will let you live. Please, I like the word in there, he's on his knees, he's begging, please, Sarah, say you are my sister, so it'll go well with me because of you, that I may live on account of you. Now this wasn't really a lie, because Genesis chapter 20 will tell us that she is his half-sister. They have the same father back before God gave the penalties for marriage within the family. So she is his half-sister. So he's clever. He says, I'm not really lying, I'm just telling a half-truth. Tell him you're my sister, and everything will be okay. We'll stay here, we'll get all the food we need, we'll survive, we'll slip back into Canaan, everything will be all right. So she does. Now we know that a common practice in this day was if the Pharaoh wanted a woman, he respected marriage enough to kill the husband to get her. That was as far as his respect went. As a matter of fact, this is exactly the practice that David did. You remember? He saw Bathsheba. He wanted her, so he took care of the husband. He adopted the practice of a pagan pharaoh. And by the way, I think that's probably the reason why the people never said anything. They were pagans too. So they said, well, our king is acting just like the pharaohs of Egypt. He took care of the husband. Fine, this is the way it is. Until Nathan confronted him. But this was the practice, and this is exactly what would have happened. Verse 14, and it came about that when Abraham came into Egypt, the Egyptians saw that this woman was beautiful. She was 65 years old, probably with the length of life they lived, she would be somewhere around 35 years of age in respect to how long we seem to live on planet Earth. So she was really reaching the blossom of her womanhood, and he knew that as soon as they laid eyes on her, he was no dummy, she was beautiful. And he knew that they would knock him off. So the Pharaoh's officials saw her and praised her to Pharaoh. Now note this. This is a shock to Abraham. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. Uh-oh. He didn't anticipate this. He didn't think that it'd go this far. Now the custom was for there to be 12 months of preparation when a woman was being added to the harem. Until that time, she was simply taken care of and Pharaoh didn't touch her. But after 12 months, she would be added to that harem officially. Now, I don't know how much further we went down the pike, but I just imagine Abraham sitting, you know, in his tent, alone, realizing that now he's really gone way too far. Read a story by Gary Richmond that intrigued me. He used to work for the Los Angeles Zoo. In fact, I think I included one of his stories in our communique one month. He talked about the day when the curators of the reptile section of the zoo needed to perform surgery on a king cobra. And so they solicited his help. He was on staff and they said, look, Gary, you come with about four of us. We're going to go into the cage of this king cobra. And I think the king cobra was about 10 feet long. You know, it has the cape that spreads as they stand almost as it were erect. So he comes along and they say, now what you'll do is you'll help the surgeon. You'll grab the head. Three of the other men will grab the body. And then once you've got it, somebody else will take over, and then you help me with the surgery. So they walk into this reptile cage. It's huge. Soon enough, here comes this king cobra around the corner, and it's as if he recognized, he saw, and he immediately, as it were, stood. He spread his cape, and the story says that he looked back and forth at each of the five men as if he were selecting his prey. Gary Richmond is standing there, his knees knocking, and sure enough, the snake darted at one of the men, and he was expert and leapt out of the path of the snake and then grabbed a hold of the body, and soon all five men had a hold on the snake. So Gary is helping the surgeon, and the surgeon says, look, you take some towels, and I want you to wad them up, and I want you to stick them in the snake's mouth. And he says the snake is growling and hissing, and it's long fangs, and they have defanged this thing. In fact, it has the venom sacs. Venom strong enough to kill an elephant. And so Gary Richmond wads up the paper towels and sticks it in the snake's mouth, and the snake chomps down on those things. It begins to grind, and he says that venom drips from those towels. The surgeon said that the reason we do this is because the difficulty is not really catching the snake. The tough part's letting it go and getting out without getting bit. So we milk this thing, as it were. We take the venom, we drain the venom, so that if he perchance gets a hold of one of us, we won't die. He has no venom. And then he went on to illustrate this story in a way that I found here. Here is Abraham, in an effect, easily grabbing on this snake. Hey, a little lie, a little half-truth, we'll have it made. Now he is embracing in his tent a serpent that is venomous. He's probably looking over his shoulder constantly, wondering if his lie has been discovered and they're coming to take his head. Just outside, another deposit of cattle has arrived with a note from the Pharaoh. Thank you, Abraham, for coming to Egypt. Oh, that sister of yours, she's mine in 3 months. And it all started with a little lie. My friends, dishonesty is an epidemic in the church. I understand in 1811 they started in Washington, D.C. a conscience fund. When a man sent in $5 he had stolen from his taxes. They have it today. In fact, they've received nearly $4 million. Well, there's hope because of the first phrase of verse 17. Would you circle the words, but the Lord? Oh, man. No hope. What's Abraham going to do? Go up to the Pharaoh and say, Pharaoh, I lied. I'd like my wife back. No way. So the Lord intervenes and struck Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abram's wife. And then Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this you've done to me? Why did you not tell me that this was your wife? Why did you say, she is my sister, so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go. Now, I don't want you to get the idea now that, oh great, no problems, everything's taken care of, God intervenes, Abraham's off the hook. No, I'm going to give you several consequences from Abram's sin. First of all, lost blessing. If he had stayed at the altar at Bethel, if he had called to God because his needs weren't being met, God would have responded miraculously or in some way to provide for him, like he did Moses, the children of Israel, Elijah, and all the others. But as a result, he lost the blessing of seeing God work, seeing God provide for his need, because he rested on his reason. So often you and I forfeit the blessing of God because instead of waiting on him to provide, we figure it all out. Secondly, an increase in possessions. When he left Egypt, verse 2 of chapter 13, he was very rich. How is this a consequence? Because these riches would now cause the dispute among the herdsmen of Abram and the herdsmen of Lot, where they would finally have a family split. Don't ever think it's inevitable that when you and I grow rich, it's the blessing of God. In Canaan, in the will of God, Abram was living hand to mouth. In Egypt, out of the will of God, he was getting rich. I don't mean to imply that when you stay in Canaan that poverty is the hand of God, nor that riches are the hand of Satan. But in this case, that was in fact true. Thirdly, when Sarah left Egypt, she brought along with her a little maidservant to help, named Hagar. And this little maid would bear a son because Abraham would once again listen to his reason. Fourth, Lot evidently developed a taste for Egypt that persisted. He took Lot back out of Egypt, but he couldn't get Egypt out of Lot. And how tragic it is when a more mature believer who ought to know better leads a younger believer astray. I want you to notice the fifth thing in verse 18, you may not have caught it. Let's read it together, and that's a lost testimony. Would you note again, Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this you've done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? He is confronted by a man who at this particular point in his life is more godly than Abraham is. And he's a pagan Pharaoh. And Pharaoh is straightening out his ethics. He's clearing up his morals. Well, is there hope? Yeah, let me give you a reason why. Because Abram returned to the altar. Look at chapter 13. In verse 20 of chapter 12, they're escorted out of Egypt. I mean, they took him right to the border and said, "We never want to see you again." Chapter 13, verse 1, "So Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, he and his wife, and all that belonged to him, and Lot with him. Now Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and in gold. And he went on his journeys from the Negev as far as Bethel," note this, "to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, to the place of the altar which he had made there formerly." What is Abram telling us? A couple of things. First of all, go back to the place of departure. Go back to where it was that the fork came in the road and you went left and God said, "I want to go right." You want to straighten it all out? Go back to the place where you departed. I don't know about you, but your Egypt may be a bar. Your Egypt may be the principal's office for cheating. Your Egypt may be in front of a cable television set where you secretly watch immorality. Your Egypt may be in the home of another man or another woman. Or your Egypt may be much more subtle, like telephone conversations riddled with gossip, an unused Bible that's dusty that has marked on it the invisible words, "For Sundays only." But you're in Egypt. Go back to the place of departure. Abraham is also telling us, go back to the place of dependence. Would you notice the last part of verse 4? "And there Abram called on the name of the Lord." In your life, just how essential is God? How often do you hear yourself say the words, "I can do it myself. Leave it to me"? Go back to the place like Abram where he once again called on the name of the Lord. A place of dependency. Let me apply this passage four ways. Number one, don't be surprised when famine arrives in your life. It's as if we're shocked. But the path of faith is an ascending hill that is designed by God to develop the muscles of our faith. The journey is not a level plane where we can casually stroll. It isn't a descending hill upon which we can coast. That's not faith. It's a climb. And that famine is designed by God to help you on your way. Secondly, famine comes to test and strengthen our dependence on the Lord. Even when He seems silent, even when He's distant, even when He is unfair, trust in the Lord then with all thy heart. Lean not to thine own understanding, in all thy ways acknowledge, trust, depend on Him, and He will direct thy paths. Third, God never runs short of patience. This is an amazing thing. If I had been God, I'd have said, "Abraham, you are a loser. I'll go get another person to fulfill the covenant I've given to Israel. Forget it. You have caused the heathen to blaspheme my name. You almost gave your wife away. I'll find somebody else." But he didn't. The story is told of Thomas Edison, who was working on improving his first light bulb, and he finished it, and he handed the finished bulb to a young boy, an assistant in the lab. And that boy had to take it to the vacuum chamber up some stairs, and he cautiously took each step one at a time. But then at the last minute, he dropped the bulb, and it shattered in 1,000 pieces. The whole staff had to spend another 24 hours making another bulb. And when they finished, to the amazement of all of the staff, Edison handed the newly made bulb back to the same boy. That probably marked him for life. Changed that boy's life, I would imagine. This time he accomplished the job. Multiply that by 10 million. That is how God is patient with His children. There we are in the middle of Egypt. And God still cares. Let me give you one other one. Going to another source for help will never solve what faith in God can. If we would only get that through our heads, Egypt will never help. It will never satisfy. There are no altars in Egypt. There's no fellowship in Egypt. No worship in Egypt. We have to return to Bethel, the place of fellowship, the place of worship, the place where God patiently waits for you and I to return.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is copyrighted and may be shared, but not sold or altered. For information or to access more resources, visit wisdomonline.org.